Part 5, Chapter 1. Princess Sheshchabatskaya considered that it was out of the question for the wedding to take place before Lent, just 5 weeks off, since not half the trousseau could possibly be ready by that time. But she couldn't but agree with Levin that to fix it for after Lent would be putting it off too late, as an old aunt of Prince Sheshchabatsky's was seriously ill and might die, and then the mourning would delay the wedding still longer. And therefore, deciding to divide the trousseau into two parts, a larger and smaller trousseau, the princess consented to have the wedding before Lent. She determined that she would get the smaller part of the trousseau all ready now, and the larger part should be made later, and she was very angry with Levin, because he was incapable of giving her a serious answer to the question whether he agreed to this arrangement or not. The arrangement was the more convenient, because immediately after the wedding, the young people were to go to the country, where the more important part of the trousseau would not be needed. Levin still continued in the same delirious condition in which it seemed to him that he and his happiness constituted the chief and sole aim of all existence, and that he need not now think or care about anything, that everything was being done and would be done for him by others. He had not even plans and aims for the future. He left its arrangement to others, knowing that everything would be delightful. His brother, Sergei Ivanovitch, Stepan Arkadyevitch, and the princess directed him in doing what he had to do. All he did was to agree entirely with everything suggested to him. His brother raised money for him. The princess advised him to leave Moscow after the wedding. Stepan Arkadyevitch advised him to go abroad. He agreed to everything. "Do what you like if it amuses you. I'm happy, and my happiness can be no greater and no less because of anything you do," he thought. When he told Kitty of Stepan Arkadyevitch's suggestion that they go abroad, he was much surprised that she didn't agree to this, and had some definite proposals of her own regarding their future. She knew Levin had work he loved in the country. She did not, as he saw it, understand this work. She didn't even care to understand it. But that didn't prevent her from regarding it as a matter of great importance. And besides, she knew their home would be in the country, and she wanted to go, not abroad, where she was not going to live, but to the place where their home would be. This strongly expressed intention astonished Levin, but since he didn't care either way, he immediately asked Stepan Arkadyevitch, as though it was his duty, to go down to the country and to arrange everything there according to his own good taste, of which he had so much. "But look," Stepan Arkadyevitch had said to him one day after he had come back from the country, where he had got everything ready for the young people's arrival. "Have you a certificate showing you've received communion?" "No, but what of it?" "You can't be married without it."
"Aye, aye, aye," cried Levin. "Why, I think it's 9 years since I've been to communion. I never thought of it."
"You're a prize package," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, laughing, "and you call me a nihilist. But this won't do, you know. You must confess and take the sacrament."
"When?"
"There are only 4 days left now."
Stepan Arkadyevitch arranged this also, and Levin had to prepare himself for confession. To Levin, as to any unbeliever who respects the belief of others, it was exceedingly disagreeable to be present at and take part in church ceremonies. At this moment, in his present softened state of feeling, sensitive to everything, this inevitable act of hypocrisy was not merely painful to Levin, it seemed to him utterly impossible. Now, in the heyday of his glory, his fullest flowering, he would have to be a liar or a blasphemer. He felt incapable of being either. But though he repeatedly plied Stepan Arkadyevitch with questions as to the possibility of obtaining a certificate without going to communion, Stepan Arkadyevitch maintained that it was out of the question.
"Besides, what's it to you? 2 days? And the priest is a very nice and sensible old man. He'll pull the tooth out for you so gently you won't notice it."
Standing at the first mass, Levin attempted to revive in himself his youthful recollections of the intense religious emotion he had passed through between the ages of 16 and 17. But he was at once convinced that it was utterly impossible for him. He attempted to look at it all as an empty custom, having no sort of meaning, like the custom of paying calls. But he felt that he couldn't do that either. Levin found himself, like the majority of his contemporaries, in the vaguest position in regard to religion. Believe he could not, and at the same time he had no firm convictions that it was all wrong, and consequently, not being able to believe in the significance of what he was doing, or to regard it with indifference as an empty formality, during the whole period of preparing for the sacrament, he was conscious of a feeling of discomfort and shame at doing what he did not himself understand, and what, as an inner voice told him, was therefore false and wrong. During the service, he would first listen to the prayers, trying to attach some meaning to them not in conflict with his own views. Then, feeling he couldn't understand and must condemn them, he tried not to listen to them, but to attend to the thoughts, observations, and memories which floated through his brain with extreme vividness during the time he was standing idly in church. He stood through the Mass, Vespers, and Evensong, and the next day he got up earlier than usual, and without having tea, went to the church at 8 o'clock in the morning for the morning service and the confession. There was no one in the church but a beggar soldier, two old women, and the church officials. A young deacon, whose long back showed in two distinct halves through his thin under-cassock, met him, and at once, going to a small table by the wall, read the prayers. During the reading, especially at the frequent and rapid repetition of the same words, "Lord, have mercy on us," which sounded like "Lord, have mercy upon us," Levin felt that his mind was shut and sealed up, and that it must not be touched or stirred now, or confusion would be the result. And so, standing behind the deacon, he went on thinking of his own affairs, neither listening nor examining what was said. "It's wonderful what expression there is in her hand," he thought, remembering how they'd been sitting the day before at a corner table. They had nothing to talk about, as was almost always the case at this time, and laying her hand on the table, she kept opening and shutting it, and laughed herself as she watched her action. He remembered how he had kissed it, and then had examined the lines on the pink palm. "Again, Lord have mercy, Pons," thought Levin, crossing himself, bowing, and looking at the supple movements of the deacon's back bowing before him. "She took my hand then and examined the lines. 'You've got a splendid hand,' she said." And he looked at his own and at the stumpy hand of the deacon. "Yes, now it will soon be over," he thought. "No, seems to be beginning again," he thought, listening to the prayers. "No, it's just ending. Here he is, bowing down to the ground. That's always at the end." The deacon's hand, in a velvet cuff, stealthily accepted a 3-ruble note, and he said he would put down Levin's name. His new boots clattered over the flagstones of the empty church as he went jauntily to the chancel. A moment later he peeked out and beckoned to Levin. Thought, till then locked up, began to stir in Levin's head, but he made haste to drive it away. "It will come right somehow," he thought, and went towards the ambo. He went up the steps, and turning to the right, saw the priest. The priest, a little old man with a scant, grizzled beard and weary, good-natured eyes, was standing near the lectern, turning over the pages of a missal. With a slight bow to Levin, he began immediately reading prayers in the stereotyped voice. When he had finished them, he bowed down to the ground and turned, facing Levin.
"Christ is present here unseen, receiving your confession," he said, pointing to the crucifix. "Do you believe in all the doctrines of the Holy Apostolic Church?" the priest went on, turning his eyes away from Levin's face and folding his hands under his stole.
"I have doubted, and I still doubt everything," said Levin, in a voice unpleasant to him, and he ceased speaking. The priest waited a few seconds to see if he would add anything more, and closing his eyes, he said quickly, with a strong provincial accent, emphasizing the O's,
"Doubt is natural to the weakness of mankind, but we must pray that God in his mercy will strengthen us. What are your particular sins?" he added, without the slightest pause, as though anxious not to waste time.
"My chief sin is doubt. I have doubts about everything, and am most of the time in doubt."
"Doubt is natural to the weakness of mankind," the priest repeated the same words. "What do you doubt particularly?"
"I doubt everything. I sometimes even have doubts of the existence of God." Levin couldn't help saying, and he was horrified at the impropriety of what he was saying. But Levin's words did not, it seemed, make much impression on the priest.
"What sort of doubt can there be of the existence of God?" he said hurriedly, with a barely perceptible smile.
Levin didn't speak.
"What doubt can you have of the Creator when you behold his creation?" the priest went on in the rapid, customary jargon. "Who has decked the heavenly firmament with its stars? Who has clothed the earth in its beauty? How could it be without the Creator?" he said, looking inquiringly at Levin.
Levin felt that it would be improper to enter upon a metaphysical discussion with the priest, and so he said in reply merely what was a direct answer to the question. "I don't know," he said.
"You don't know? Then how can you doubt that God created all?" the priest said, with good-humoured perplexity. "I don't understand it at all," said Levin, blushing, feeling that his words were stupid, and that they could not be anything but stupid in such a situation. "Pray to God and beseech him. Even the Holy Fathers had doubts and prayed to God to strengthen their faith. The devil has great power, and we must resist him. Pray to God, beseech him, pray to God," he repeated hurriedly.
The priest paused for some time, as though meditating.
"You're about, I hear, to marry the daughter of my parishioner and spiritual son, Prince Shishchabatsky," he resumed with a smile. "An excellent young lady."
"Yes," answered Levin, blushing for the priest. "Why does he want to ask me about this at confession?" he thought. And as though answering his thought, the priest said to him,
"You are about to enter into holy matrimony, and God may bless you with offspring. Well, what sort of an education can you give your babes if you do not overcome the temptation of the devil enticing you to infidelity?" he said, with gentle reproachfulness. "If you love your child as a good father, you will desire not only wealth, luxury, honour for your infant. You will be anxious for his salvation, his spiritual enlightenment with the light of truth, eh? What answer will you make him when the innocent babe asks you, 'Papa, who made all that enchants me in this world, the earth, the waters, the sun, the flowers, the grass?' Can you say to him, 'I don't know'? You cannot but know, since the Lord God in his infinite mercy has revealed it to us. Or your child will ask you, 'What awaits me in the life beyond the tomb?' What will you say to him when you know nothing? How will you answer him? Will you leave him to the temptations of the world and the devil?" "That's not right," he said.
And he stopped, putting his head on one side and looking at Levin with his kindly, gentle eyes. Levin made no answer this time, not because he didn't want to enter upon a discussion with the priest, but because, so far, no one had ever asked him such questions. And when his babes did ask him those questions, it would be time enough to think about answering them.
"You are entering upon a time of life," pursued the priest, "when you must choose your path and keep to it. Pray to God that he may, in his mercy, aid you and have mercy on you," he concluded. "May our Lord Jesus Christ, in the abundance and riches of his loving kindness, forgive this, his child."
And finishing the prayer of absolution, the priest blessed him and let him go. On getting home that day, Levin had a delightful sense of relief at the awkward position being over and having been through it without his having to tell a lie. Apart from this, there remained a vague memory that what the kind, nice old fellow had said had not been at all so stupid as he had thought at first, and that there was something in it that must be cleared up.
"Of course, not now," thought Levin, "but some day later on."
Levin felt more than ever now that there was something not clear and not clean in his soul, and that in regard to religion he was in the same position he perceived so clearly and disliked in others, and for which he blamed his friend Shiavsky. Levin spent that evening with his betrothed at Dolly's, and was in very high spirits. To explain to Stepan Arkadyevitch the state of excitement in which he found himself, he said that he was as happy as a dog being trained to jump through a hoop, who, having at last caught the idea and done what was required of it, whines and wags its tail and jumps for joy on the table and the window sills. Chapter 2. On the day of the wedding, according to Russian custom, the princess and Darya Alexandrovna insisted on strictly keeping all the customs, Levin didn't see his bride, and dined at his hotel with three bachelor friends, casually brought together in his rooms. These were Sergei Ivanovich, Katavasov, a university friend, now a professor of natural science, whom Levin had met in the street and insisted on taking home with him, and Chirikov, his best man, a Moscow magistrate, Levin's companion in his bear hunts. The dinner was a very merry one. Sergei Ivanovich was in his happiest mood, and was much amused by Katavasov's originality. Katavasov, feeling that his originality was appreciated and understood, made the most of it. Chirikov always gave lively and good-humoured support to conversation of any sort.
"See now," said Katavasov with a drawl, a habit acquired in the lecture room, "what a capable fellow our friend Konstantin Dmitrievich was. I'm not speaking of present company, for he's not with us any longer. At the time he left the university, he was fond of science, took an interest in humanity. Now one half of his ability is devoted to deceiving himself, and the other to justifying the deceit. A more determined enemy of matrimony than you I never saw," said Sergei Ivanovich. "Oh, no, I'm not an enemy of matrimony. I'm in favour of division of labour. People who can do nothing else ought to propagate, while the rest work for their happiness and enlightenment. That's how I look at it. To muddle up two trades is the error of the amateur. I'm not one of them." "How happy I shall be when I hear that you're in love," said Levin. "Please invite me to the wedding."
"I'm in love already."
"Yes, with a cuttlefish. You know," Levin turned to his brother, "Mikhail Semyonovich is writing a work on the digestive organs of the now make a mess of it. Doesn't matter what about. The fact is, I certainly do love cuttlefish."
"But that's no hindrance to your loving your wife."
"The cuttlefish is no hindrance. The wife is the hindrance."
"Why so?"
"Oh, you'll see. You care about farming, hunting. Well, you'll find out."
"Our keep was here today. He said there were a lot of elks in Prudnoia,
and two bears," said Chirikov.
"Well, you must go and get them without me."
"Ah, that's the truth," said Sergei Ivanovich. "And you may say goodbye to bear hunting for the future. Your wife won't allow it."
Levin smiled. The picture of his wife not letting him go was so pleasant that he was ready to renounce the delights of seeing bears forever.
"Still, it's a pity they should get those two bears without you. Do you remember the last time at Kapilova? That was a delightful hunt," said Chirikov.
Levin had not the heart to disillusion him of the notion that there could be something delightful apart from her, and so said nothing.
"There's some sense in this custom of saying goodbye to bachelor life," said Sergei Ivanovich. "However happy you may be, you must regret your freedom. And confess you feel you want to jump out of the window like Gogol's bridegroom." "Of course he does, but he won't admit it," said Katavasov, and he broke into loud laughter. "Oh, well, the window's open. Let's start this instant to defer. There's a big she-bear. One could go right up to the lair. Seriously, let's go by the 5 o'clock, and let them do what they like here," said Chirikov, smiling.
"Well now, on my honour," said Levin, smiling, "I can't find in my heart that feeling of regret for my freedom."
"Yes, there's such chaos in your heart just now that you can't find anything there," said Katavasov. "Wait a while. When you've settled down, you'll find it."
"No. If so, I should have felt a little, apart from my feeling," he didn't want to say love before them, "and happiness, a certain regret at losing my freedom."
"Awful. It's a hopeless case," said Katavasov. "Well, let's drink to his recovery, or wish that 1/100th part of his dreams may be realized, and that would be happiness such as never has been seen on earth."
Soon after dinner, the guests went away to be in time to get dressed for the wedding. When he was left alone, and recalled the conversation of these bachelor friends, Levin asked himself, had he in his heart that regret for his freedom of which they had spoken? He smiled at the question. Freedom. What is freedom for? Happiness is only in loving and wishing her wishes, thinking her thoughts. That is to say, not freedom at all. That's happiness.
"But do I know her ideas, her wishes, her feelings?"
some voice suddenly whispered to him. The smile died on his face, and he grew thoughtful. And suddenly a strange feeling came upon him. There came over him a dread and doubt of everything. "What if she doesn't love me? What if she's marrying me simply to be married? What if she doesn't know herself what she's doing? He asked himself. She may come to her senses, and only when she is being married realize that she does not and cannot love me. And strange, most evil thoughts of her began to come to him. He was jealous of Vronsky, as he had been a year ago, as though the evening he had seen her with Vronsky had been yesterday. He suspected she'd not told him everything. He jumped up quickly. No, this can't go on, he said to himself in despair. I'll go to her. I'll ask her. I'll say, for the last time, we are free, and hadn't we better remain so? Anything's better than endless misery, disgrace, infidelity. With despair in his heart, and bitter anger against all men, against himself, against her, he went out of the hotel and drove to her house. He found her in one of the back rooms. She was sitting on a trunk and making some arrangements with her maid, sorting out piles of dresses of different colours, spread on the backs of chairs and on the floor. Oh, she cried, seeing him and beaming with delight. Is it thou? Is it you? To this very day she sometimes said thou, sometimes you. I didn't expect you. I'm going through my wardrobe to see what's for whom.
Oh, that's very nice, he said gloomily, looking at the maid.
You can go, Dunyasha. I'll call you presently, said Kitty.
Kostya, what's the matter?
She asked, definitely adopting the familiar name as soon as the maid had gone out. She noticed his strange face agitated and gloomy, and panic came over her.
Kitty, I'm tortured. I can't suffer alone, he said with despair in his voice, standing before her and looking imploringly into her eyes.
He saw already from her loving, truthful face that nothing could come of what he had meant to say, but yet he wanted her to reassure him herself.
I've come to say that there's still time. This can all be stopped and put right.
What? I don't understand. What's the matter?
What I have said 1,000 times over and can't help thinking, that I'm not worthy of you. You couldn't consent to marry me. Think a little.
You've made a mistake. Think it over thoroughly.
You can't love me. If... Better say so, he said, not looking at her. I shall be wretched. Let people say what they like. Anything's better than misery. Far better now, while there's still time.
I don't understand, she answered, panic-stricken. You mean you want to give it up? Don't want it?
Yes, if you don't love me.
You're mad, she cried, turning crimson with vexation.
But his face was so piteous that she restrained her vexation, and flinging some clothes off an armchair, she sat down beside him.
What are you thinking? Tell me all.
I'm thinking you can't love me.
What can you love me for? My God, what can I do? She said, and burst into tears.
Oh, what have I done? He cried,
and kneeling before her, he started kissing her hands. When the princess came into the room 5 minutes later, she found them completely reconciled. Kitty had not simply answered him that she loved him, but had gone so far, in answer to his question, what she loved him for, as to explain why. She told him that she loved him because she understood him completely, because she knew what he would like, and because everything he liked was good. And this seemed to him perfectly clear. When the princess came to them, they were sitting side by side on the trunk, sorting the dresses, and disputing over Kitty's wanting to give Dunyasha the brown dress she'd been wearing when Levin proposed to her, while he insisted that that dress must never be given away, but Dunyasha must have the blue one.
How is it you don't see? She's a brunette, and it won't suit her. I've worked it all out.
Hearing why he had come, the princess was half humorously, half seriously angry with him, and sent him home to dress and not to hinder Kitty, whose hair was to be done, as Charles, the hairdresser, was expected at once.
As it is, she's been eating nothing lately and is losing her looks. And then you come along and upset her with your nonsense, she said to him. Get along with you, my dear fellow.
Levin, guilty and shame-faced but pacified, went back to his hotel. His brother, Darya Alexandrovna, and Stepan Arkadyevitch, all in full dress, were waiting for him to bless him with the icon. There was no time to lose. Darya Alexandrovna had to drive home again to fetch her curled and pomaded son, who was to drive in the bride's carriage with the icon. Then a carriage had to be sent for the best man, and another that would take Sergei Ivanovitch away would have to be sent back. Altogether there were a great many most complicated matters to be considered and arranged. One thing was certain. There must be no delay, as it was already 6:30. The ceremony of benediction was anything but solemn. Stepan Arkadyevitch stood in a comically solemn pose beside his wife, took the icon, and telling Levin to bow down to the ground, he blessed him with his kindly, ironical smile, and kissed him 3 times. Darya Alexandrovna did the same, and immediately was in a hurry to get off, and again plunged into intricate questions of the destinations of the various carriages.
"Come, I'll tell you how we'll manage. You drive in our carriage to fetch him, and Sergei Ivanovitch, if he'll be so good, will drive there and then send his carriage."
"Of course, I shall be delighted." "We'll come immediately with him. Are your things sent off?" said Stepan Arkadyevitch.
"Yes," answered Levin, and he told Kuzma to lay out his clothes. Chapter 3 A crowd of people, principally women, was thronging around the church, lighted up for the wedding. Those who had not succeeded in getting into the main entrance were crowding about the windows, pushing, wrangling, and peeping through the gratings. More than 20 carriages had already been drawn up in ranks along the street by the police. A police officer, ignoring the frost, stood at the entrance, resplendent in his uniform. More carriages were continually driving up, and ladies were wearing flowers in their hair and carrying their trains, and men were taking off their military caps or black hats as they entered the church. Inside the church, both chandeliers and all the candles before the icons were lighted. The golden glitter of the crimson background of the iconostasis, the gilt chasing of the icons, the silver of the chandeliers and candlesticks, the flagstone of the floor, the mats, the banners above the choir, the steps of the ambo, the books blackened with age, the cassocks and surplices, all were flooded with light. On the right side of the warm church, in the crowd of frock coats and white ties, uniforms and broadcloth, velvet, satin, hair and flowers, bare shoulders and arms and long gloves, there was discreet but lively conversation that echoed strangely in the high cupola. Every time the creak of the open door was heard, the conversation in the crowd died away, and everybody looked around expecting to see the bride and bridegroom come in. But the door had opened more than 10 times, and each time it was either a belated guest or guests who joined the circle of the invited on the right, or a spectator who had eluded or softened the police officer and went to join the crowd of outsiders on the left. Both the guests and the outside public had by now passed through all the phases of anticipation. At first they imagined that the bride and bridegroom would arrive immediately, and attached no importance at all to their being late. Then they began to look more and more often toward the door, and to talk of whether anything could have happened. Then the long delay began to be positively discomforting, and relations and guests tried to look as if they were not thinking of the bridegroom, but were engrossed in conversation. The archdeacon, as though to remind them of the value of his time, coughed impatiently, making the window panes quiver in their frames. In the choir, the bored choristers could be heard trying their voices and blowing their noses. The priest was continually sending first the beadle and then the deacon to find out whether the bridegroom had come. More and more often he went himself, in a lilac vestment and an embroidered sash, to the side door, expecting to see the bridegroom. At last, one of the ladies, glancing at her watch, said, "It really is strange, though," and all the guests became uneasy and began loudly expressing their wonder and dissatisfaction. One of the bridegroom's best men went to find out what had happened. Kitty, meanwhile, had long since been ready, and in her white dress and long veil and wreath of orange blossoms, she was standing in the drawing-room of the Shishchabatsky's house with her sister, Madame Ulvova, who was her nuptial godmother. She was looking out of the window, and for over half an hour had been anxiously expecting to hear from the best man that her bridegroom was at the church. Levin, meanwhile, in his trousers, but without his coat and vest, was walking to and fro in his room at the hotel, continually putting his head out of the door and looking up and down the corridor. But in the corridor there was no sign of the person he was looking for, and he came back in despair, and frantically waving his hands, he addressed Stepan Arkadyevitch, who was smoking serenely. "Was ever a man in such an absolutely idiotic situation?" he said.
"Yes, it is stupid," Stepan Arkadyevitch assented, smiling soothingly. "But don't worry, it'll be brought in a minute." "No, what is to be done?" said Levin with smothered fury. "And these idiotic open vests, out of the question," he said, looking at the crumpled front of his shirt. "And what if the things have been taken to the railway station?" he roared in desperation. "Then you must put on mine. I should have done so long ago." "It's not nice to look ridiculous. Wait, it will work out."
What had happened was that when Levin asked for his evening suit, Kuzma, his old servant, had brought him the coat, vest, and everything that was needed.
"But the shirt!" cried Levin. "You've got a shirt on," Kuzma answered with a placid smile.
Kuzma hadn't thought of leaving out a clean shirt, and on receiving instructions to pack up everything and send it round to the Shishchabatsky's house, from which the young people were to set out the same evening, he had done so, packing everything but the dress suit. The shirt, worn since the morning, was crumpled and out of the question with a fashionable open vest. It was a long way to send to the Shishchabatsky's. They sent out to buy a shirt. The servant came back. Everything was locked up. It was Sunday. They sent to Stepan Arkadyevitch's and bought a shirt. It was impossibly wide and short. They sent finally to the Shishchabatsky's to unpack the things. The bridegroom was expected at the church while he was pacing up and down his room like a wild beast in a cage, peeping out into the corridor, and with horror and despair recalling what absurd things he had said to Kitty and what she might be thinking now. At last the guilty Kuzma flew panting into the room with the shirt.
"Just in time. They were just lifting it into the van," said Kuzma.
3 minutes later, Levin ran full speed into the corridor, not looking at his watch for fear of aggravating his sufferings.
"You won't help matters like this," said Stepan Arkadyevitch with a smile, following without haste. "It will work out. It will work out, I tell you."
Chapter 4.
"They've come. Here he is. Which one? The younger one, eh? Why, poor dear, she looks more dead than alive,"
were the comments in the crowd when Levin, meeting his bride in the entrance, walked with her into the church. Stepan Arkadyevitch told his wife the cause of the delay, and the guests were whispering it with smiles to one another. Levin saw nothing and no one. He didn't take his eyes off his bride. Everyone said she had lost her looks the last few days, and was not nearly so pretty in her wedding dress as usual, but Levin didn't think so. He looked at her hair done up high, with the long white veil and white flowers, and the high, stand-up, scalloped collar that in such a maidenly fashion hid her long neck at the sides and only showed it in front, at her strikingly slender figure, and it seemed to him that she looked better than ever, not because these flowers, this veil, this gown from Paris added anything to her beauty, but because, in spite of the elaborate sumptuousness of her attire, the expression of her sweet face, of her eyes, of her lips, was still her own characteristic expression of guileless truthfulness. "I was beginning to think you meant to run away," she said, and smiled to him.
"It's so stupid what happened to me, I'm ashamed to speak of it," he said, reddening,
and he was obliged to turn to Sergei Ivanovitch, who came up to him.
"Lovely story of yours about the shirt," said Sergei Ivanovitch, shaking his head and smiling.
"Yes, yes," answered Levin, without any idea of what they were talking about.
"Now, Kostya, you have to decide," said Stepan Arkadyevitch with an air of mock dismay. "A weighty question. You are, at this moment, just in the mood to appreciate all its gravity. They ask me, are they to light the candles that have been lighted before, or candles that have never been lighted? It's a matter of 10 rubles, he added, relaxing his lips into a smile. "I've decided, but I was afraid you might not agree."
Levin saw that it was a joke, but he couldn't smile.
Well, what's it to be then? Unlighted or lighted candles? That is the question.
Yes, yes, unlighted.
Oh, I'm very glad. The question's decided, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling.
How stupid men are, though, in this situation, he said to Tchurikov, when Levin, after looking absently at him, had moved back to his bride.
Kitty, careful you're the first to step on the carpet, said Countess Nordston, coming up. You're something, she said to Levin. Aren't you frightened, eh?
Said Maria Dmitrievna, an old aunt.
Are you cold? You're pale. Stop a minute, stoop down, said Kitty's sister, Madame Ulvova,
and with her plump, beautiful arms, she smilingly arranged the flowers on her head.
Dolly came up, tried to say something, but couldn't speak, cried, and then laughed unnaturally.
Kitty looked at all of them with the same faraway eyes as Levin. Her only response to everything said to her was a smile of happiness which came naturally to her now. Meanwhile, the officiating clergy had got into their vestments, and the priest and deacon came out to the lectern, which stood in the forepart of the church. The priest turned to Levin, saying something.
Levin didn't hear what the priest said.
"Take the bride's hand and lead her," the best man said to Levin.
It was a long while before Levin could make out what was expected of him. For a long time they tried to put him right and made him begin again,
because he kept taking Kitty by the wrong arm, or with the wrong arm,
till he understood at last that what he had to do was, without changing his position, take her right hand in his right hand. When at last he had taken the bride's hand in the correct way, the priest walked a few paces in front of them and stopped at the lectern. The crowd of friends and relations moved after them with a buzz of talk and a rustle of skirts. Someone stooped down and pulled out the bride's train. The church became so still that the drops of wax could be heard falling from the candles. The little old priest, in his ecclesiastical cap, with his locks of grey hair glistening like silver, combed back behind his ears, was fumbling with something at the lectern, freeing his little old hands from under the heavy silver vestment with the gold cross on the back of it. Stepan Arkadyevitch approached him cautiously, whispered something, and making a sign to Levin, walked back again. The priest lighted two candles wreathed with flowers, and holding them sideways so that the wax dropped slowly from them, he turned, facing the bridal pair. The priest was the same old man who had confessed Levin. He looked with weary and melancholy eyes at the bride and bridegroom, sighed, and putting his right hand out from his vestment, blessed the bridegroom with it, and also, with a shade of solicitous tenderness, laid the crossed fingers on the bowed head of Kitty. Then he gave them the candles, and taking the censer, he moved slowly away from them. "Can it be true?" thought Levin, and he looked around at his bride. Looking down at her, he saw her face in profile, and from the scarcely perceptible quiver of her lips and eyelashes, he knew she was aware of his eyes upon her. She didn't look around, but the high scalloped collar, which reached her little pink ear, trembled faintly. He saw that a sigh was held back in her throat, and the little hand in the long glove shook as it held the candle. All the fuss of the shirt, of being late, all the talk of friends and relations, their annoyance, his ludicrous situation, all suddenly passed away, and he was filled with joy and dread.
The handsome, stately senior deacon, wearing a silver robe and his curled locks parted in the middle, stepped smartly forward, and lifting his stole with the practised movement of two fingers, he stood opposite the priest. "Blessed be the name of the Lord!" The solemn syllables rang out slowly, one after another, setting the air quivering with waves of sound.
"Blessed be the name of our God, now and hereafter!" the little old priest answered in a submissive, piping voice, still fingering something at the lectern.
And the full chorus of the unseen choir rose up, filling the whole church from the windows to the vaulted roof with broad waves of melody. It grew stronger, rested for an instant, and slowly died away. They prayed, as they always do, for peace from on high, and for salvation, for the Holy Synod, and for the Tsar. They prayed, too, for the servants of God, Konstantin and Yekaterina, now plighting their troth. Vouchsafe to them love made perfect, peace and help, O Lord, we beseech thee. The whole church seemed to breathe with the voice of the senior deacon. Levin heard the words, and they impressed him. How did they guess that it is help, just help that one needs, he thought, recalling all his fears and doubts of late. What do I know? What can I do in this fearful business, he thought, without help? Yes, it is help I need now. When the deacon had finished the liturgical prayer, the priest turned to the bridal pair with a book. Eternal God, that join us together in love them that were separate, he read in a gentle, piping voice, who hath ordained the union of holy wedlock that cannot be set asunder. Thou who didst bless Isaac and Rebekah and their descendants according to thy holy covenant, bless thy servants Constantine and Yekaterina, leading them in the path of all good works. For gracious and merciful art thou, our Lord, and glory be to thee, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, now and for ever and ever. Amen, the unseen choir sent floating again through the air. Join us together in love them that were separate. What deep meaning in those words, and how they correspond with what one feels at this moment, thought Levin. Is she feeling the same as I? And looking around, he met her eyes, and from their expression he concluded that she was understanding it just as he was. But this was a mistake. She almost completely missed the meaning of the words of the service. She hadn't heard them, in fact. She couldn't listen to them and take them in. So strong was the one feeling that filled her breast and grew stronger and stronger. That feeling was joy at the completion of the process that for the last month and a half had been going on in her soul, and had during those 6 weeks been a joy and a torture to her. On the day when in the drawing-room of the house on Arbat she had gone up to him in her brown dress and accepted him without a word, on that day, at that hour, there took place in her heart a complete severance from her old life, and a quite different, new, utterly strange life had begun for her, while the old life was actually going on as before. Those 6 weeks had for her been a time of the utmost bliss and the utmost misery. All her life, all her desires and hopes were concentrated on this one man, still not understood by her, to whom she was bound by a feeling of alternate attraction and repulsion, even less comprehended than the man himself. And all the while she was going on living in the outward conditions of her old life. Living the old life, she was horrified at herself, at her utter insurmountable callousness to her own past, to things, to habits, to the people she had loved, who loved her, to her mother who was wounded by her indifference, to her kind, tender father, till then dearer than all the world. At one moment she was horrified at this indifference, at another she rejoiced at what had brought her to this indifference. She couldn't frame a thought, not a wish, apart from life with this man, but this new life was not yet, and she could not even picture it clearly to herself. There was only anticipation and the dread and joy of the new and the unknown. And now, behold, anticipation and uncertainty and remorse at the abandonment of the old life was all ending, and the new was beginning. This new life could not but have terrors for her inexperience. But, terrible or not, the change had been wrought 6 weeks before in her soul, and this was merely the final sanction of what had long been completed in her heart. Turning again to the lectern, the priest with some difficulty picked up Kitty's little ring, and asking Levin for his hand, he put it on the tip of his finger. The servant of God, Constantine, plights his troth to the servant of God, Yekaterina, and putting the big ring on Kitty's touchingly weak, rosy little finger, the priest said the same thing. And the bridal pair tried several times to understand what they had to do, and each time made some mistake and were corrected by the priest in a whisper. At last, having duly done what was necessary, having made the sign of the cross over them with the rings, the priest handed Kitty the big ring and Levin the little one. Again they were puzzled, and passed the rings from hand to hand, still without doing what was expected. Dolly, Chirikov, and Stepan Arkadyevitch stepped forward to help them.
There was an interval of hesitation, whispering, and smiles, but the expression of solemn emotion on the faces of the betrothed pair didn't change. On the contrary, in their perplexity over their hands, they looked more grave and deeply moved than before, and the smile with which Stepan Arkadyevitch whispered to them that now they could each put on their own ring died away on his lips. He had a feeling that any smile would pain them.
"Thou who didst from the beginning create male and female," the priest read after the exchange of rings, "from thee woman was given to man to be a helpmeet to him, and for the procreation of children. O Lord, our God, who has poured down the blessings of thy truth according to thy holy covenant upon thy chosen servants, our fathers from generation to generation, bless thy servants Konstantin and Yekaterina, and make their troth fast in faith and union of hearts, and truth and love."
Levin felt more and more that all his ideas of marriage, all his dreams of how he would arrange his life, were mere childishness, and that it was something he had never understood, and now understood less than ever, though it was happening to him. In his breast, a tremor rose higher and higher, and tears that wouldn't be checked came into his eyes.
Chapter 5.
In the church there was all Moscow, all the friends and relations, and during the ceremony of plighting troth in the brilliantly lighted church, there was an incessant flow of discreetly subdued talk in the circle of gaily dressed women and girls, and men in white ties, frock coats, and uniforms. The talk was principally kept up by the men, while the women were absorbed in watching every detail of the ceremony, which always means so much to them. In the little group nearest to the bride were her two sisters, Dolly and the elder one, the calm beauty, Madame Ulvova, who had just arrived from abroad.
"Why is it Maria's in lilac, as bad as black at a wedding?" said Madame Korsunskaya. "With her complexion it's the one salvation," Princess Drubetskaya responded. "I wonder why they had the wedding in the evening. It's like what tradespeople do."
"So much prettier. I was married in the evening, too," answered Madame Korsunskaya, and she sighed, remembering how charming she had been that day, and how absurdly in love her husband was, and how different it all was now.
"They say if anyone's best man more than 10 times, he'll never be married. I wanted to be for the 10th time, but the post was taken," said Count Sinyavin to the pretty Princess Chaskaya, who had designs on him.
Princess Chaskaya only answered with a smile. She looked at Kitty, thinking how and when she would stand with Count Sinyavin in Kitty's place, and how she would remind him then of his joke today. Young Shishchabatsky told the old lady-in-waiting, Madame Nikolaeva, that he meant to put the crown on Kitty's chignon for luck.
"She should not have worn a chignon," answered Madame Nikolaeva,
who had long ago made up her mind that if the elderly widower she was angling for married her, the wedding should be of the simplest.
"I don't like such grandeur."
Sergei Ivanovitch was talking to Darya Dmitrievna, jestingly assuring her that the custom of going away after the wedding was becoming common, because newly married people always felt a little ashamed of themselves. "Your brother may feel proud of himself. She's a marvel of sweetness.
I believe you're envious."
"Oh, I've got over that, Darya Dmitrievna," he answered.
And a melancholy and serious expression suddenly came over his face. Stepan Arkadyevitch was telling his sister-in-law his joke about divorce.
"The wreath needs to be put straight," she answered,
not listening to him.
"What a pity she's lost her looks so," Countess Nordston said to Madame Ulvova.
"Still, he's not worth her little finger, is he?"
"Oh, I like him so."
"Not because he's my future beau-frère," answered Madame Ulvova.
"And how well he's behaving. It's so difficult, too, to behave well in such a situation, not to look ridiculous. And he's not ridiculous, and not affected. One can see he's moved."
"You expected it, I suppose?"
"Almost. She always cared for him."
"Well, we shall see which of them will step on the mat first. I warned Kitty."
"It'll make no difference," said Madame Ulvova. "We're all obedient wives. It's in our family."
Oh, I stepped on the mat before Vasili on purpose. And you, Dolly?
Dolly stood beside them. She heard them, but she didn't answer. She was deeply moved. The tears stood in her eyes, and she couldn't have spoken without crying. She was rejoicing over Kitty and Levin. Going back in thought to her own wedding, she glanced at the radiant figure of Stepan Arkadyevich, forgot the present, and remembered only her own innocent love. She recalled not only herself, but all the women she was intimate with, or with whom she was acquainted. She thought of them on the one day of their triumph, when they had stood like Kitty under the wedding crown, with love and hope and dread in their hearts, renouncing the past and stepping forward into the mysterious future. Among the brides that came back to her memory, she thought too of her darling Anna, of whose proposed divorce she had just been hearing. And she had stood just as innocent in orange flowers and bridal veil. And now, it's terribly strange, she said to herself. It was not merely the sisters, the friends and relations of the bride who were following every detail of the ceremony. Women who were complete strangers, mere spectators, were watching it excitedly, holding their breath, in fear of losing a single movement or expression of the bride and bridegroom, and angrily not answering, often not hearing, the remarks of the callous men who kept making jocular or irrelevant observations. Why has she been crying? Is she being married against her will?
Against her will to a fine fellow like that? A prince, isn't he? Is that her sister in the white satin? Just listen how the deacon booms out,
"And obey thy husband."
Are the choristers from Chudova? No, from the synod. I asked the footman. He says he's going to take her home to his country place at once. Terribly rich, they say. That's why she's being married to him.
No, they're a very nice couple.
Maria Vasilievna, you were saying that crinolines were not being worn fuller at the sides. Just look at her in the puce dress. An ambassador's wife, they say she is. How her skirt bounces out from side to side.
What a pretty dear the bride is, like a lamb decked with flowers.
Well, say what you will, we women feel for our sister.
Such were the comments in the crowd of women spectators who had succeeded in slipping in at the church door. Chapter 6. When the ceremony of plighting troth was over, the verger spread before the lectern in the middle of the church a piece of pink silk cloth. The choir sang a complicated and elaborate psalm, in which the bass and tenor sang responses to one another, and the priest, turning around, pointed the bridal pair to the pink silk mat. Though both had often heard a great deal about the saying that the one who steps first on the mat will be the head of the house, neither Levin nor Kitty were capable of thinking of it as they took the few steps toward it. They didn't hear the loud remarks and disputes that followed, some maintaining he had stepped on first, and others that both had stepped on together. After the customary questions, whether they desired to enter upon matrimony, and whether they were pledged to anyone else, and their answers, which sounded strange to themselves, the second part of the ceremony began. Kitty listened to the words of the prayer, trying to make out their meaning, but she couldn't. The feeling of triumph and radiant happiness flooded her soul more and more as the ceremony went on, and deprived her of all power of attention. They prayed.
Endow them with continence and fruitfulness, and vouchsafe that their hearts may rejoice looking upon their sons and daughters.
They alluded to God's creation of a wife from Adam's rib.
And for this cause a man shall leave father and mother, and cleave unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh.
And that
this is a great mystery.
They prayed that God would make them fruitful and bless them, like Isaac and Rebekah, Joseph, Moses, and Zipporah, and that they might look upon their children's children.
It's all beautiful, thought Kitty, catching the words, just as it should be.
And a smile of happiness, unconsciously reflected in everyone who looked at her, beamed on her radiant face.
"Put it entirely on,"
voices were heard urging, when the priest had put on the wedding crowns, and Shchebatsky, his hand shaking in its three-button glove, held the crown high above her head.
"Put it on," she whispered, smiling.
Levin looked around at her and was struck by the joyful radiance on her face, and unconsciously her feeling infected him. He too, like her, felt glad and happy. They enjoyed hearing the epistle read, and the roll of the senior deacon's voice at the last verse, awaited with such impatience by the outsiders. They enjoyed drinking out of the shallow cup of warm red wine and water. And they were still more pleased when the priest, flinging back his stole and taking both their hands in his, led them round the lectern to the accompaniment of bass voices chanting, "Rejoice, O Isaiah!" Shishchabatsky and Chirikov, supporting the crowns and entangled in the bride's train, smiling too and happy without knowing why, were at one moment lagging behind, at the next stumbling over the bridal pair as the priest came to a halt. The spark of joy kindled in Kitty seemed to have infected everyone in the church. It seemed to Levin that the priest and the deacon, too, wanted to smile just as he did. Taking the crowns off their heads, the priest read the last prayer and congratulated the young people. Levin looked at Kitty, and he had never before seen her look as she did. She was charming with the new radiance of happiness in her face. Levin longed to say something to her, but he didn't know whether it was all over. The priest got him out of his difficulty. He smiled his kindly smile and said gently, "Kiss your wife, and you kiss your husband," and took the candles out of their hands. Levin kissed her smiling lips with timid care, gave her his arm, and with a new strange sense of closeness walked out of the church. He didn't believe, he couldn't believe, that it was true. It was only when their surprised and timid eyes met that he believed in it, because he felt that they were one. After supper, the same night, the young couple left for the country. Chapter 7 Vronsky and Anna had been travelling for 3 months together in Europe. They had visited Venice, Rome, and Naples, and had just arrived at a small Italian town where they meant to stay some time. A handsome head waiter with thick pomaded hair parted from the neck upward, an evening coat, a broad white cambric shirt front, and a bunch of charms dangling on his round stomach, stood with his hands in the full curve of his pockets, looking contemptuously from under his eyelids while he gave some reply in a severe tone to a gentleman who had stopped him. Catching the sound of footsteps coming from the other side of the entry toward the staircase, the head waiter turned around, and seeing the Russian count, who had taken their best rooms, he took his hands out of his pockets deferentially, and with a bow informed him that a courier had been, and that the business about the palazzo had been arranged. The steward was prepared to sign the agreement. "Ah, I'm glad to hear it," said Vronsky. "Is Madame at home or not?"
"Madame has been out for a walk, but has returned now," answered the waiter.
Vronsky took off his soft, wide-brimmed hat, and passed his handkerchief over his perspiring brow and hair, which had grown well over his ears, and was brushed back, covering the bald patch on his head. And glancing casually at the gentleman, who still stood there gazing intently at him, he would have gone in.
"This gentleman is a Russian, and was inquiring after you," said the head waiter.
With mingled feelings of annoyance at never being able to get away from acquaintances anywhere, and longing to find some sort of diversion from the monotony of his life, Vronsky looked once more at the gentleman who had retreated, and stood still again, and at the same moment a light came into the eyes of both.
"Golenischev! Vronsky!"
It really was Golenischev, a comrade of Vronsky's in the Corps of Pages. In the Corps, Golenischev had belonged to the Liberal Party. He left the Corps without entering the army, and had never taken office under the government. Vronsky and he had gone completely different ways on leaving the Corps, and had met only once since. At that meeting, Vronsky perceived that Golenischev had taken up a sort of lofty, intellectually liberal line, and was consequently disposed to look down upon Vronsky's interests and calling in life. Hence, Vronsky had met him with the chilling and haughty manner he knew so well how to assume, the meaning of which was, "You may like or dislike my way of life. That's a matter of the most perfect indifference to me. You will have to treat me with respect if you want to know me." Golenischev had been contemptuously indifferent to the tone taken by Vronsky. This second meeting might have been expected, one would have supposed, to estrange them still more. But now they beamed and exclaimed with delight on recognizing one another. Vronsky would never have expected to be so pleased to see Golenishtchev, but probably he was not himself aware how bored he was. He forgot the disagreeable impression of their last meeting, and with a face of frank delight held out his hand to his old comrade. The same expression of delight replaced the look of uneasiness on Golenishtchev's face. "How glad I am to meet you," said Vronsky, showing his strong white teeth in a friendly smile.
"I heard the name Vronsky, but I didn't know which one. I'm very, very glad.
Let's go in. Come, tell me what you're doing."
"I've been living here for 2 years. I'm working."
"Ah," said Vronsky with interest. "Let's go in." And with the habit common with Russians, instead of saying in Russian what he wanted to keep from the servants, he began to speak in French.
"Do you know Madame Karenina? We're travelling together. I'm going to see her now," he said in French, carefully scrutinizing Golenishtchev's face. "Ah, I didn't know."
Though he did know. Golenishtchev answered indifferently. "Have you been here long?" he added.
4 days, Vronsky answered, once more scrutinizing his friend's face intently.
"Yes, he's a decent fellow, and we'll look at the thing properly," Vronsky said to himself, catching the significance of Golenishtchev's face and the change of subject. "I can introduce him to Anna." During those 3 months that Vronsky had spent abroad with Anna, he had always, on meeting new people, asked himself how the new person would look at his relations with Anna, and for the most part, in men, he had met with the proper way of looking at it. But if he had been asked, and those who looked at it properly had been asked, exactly how they did look at it, both he and they would have been greatly puzzled as to how to answer. In reality, those who, in Vronsky's opinion, had the proper view, had no sort of view at all, but behaved in general as well-bred persons behave in regard to all the complex and insoluble problems with which life is encompassed on all sides. They behaved with propriety, avoiding allusions and unpleasant questions. They assumed an air of fully comprehending the import and force of the situation, of accepting and even approving of it, but of considering it superfluous and uncalled for to put all this into words. Vronsky at once divined that Golenishtchev was of this kind, and therefore was doubly pleased to see him. And in fact, Golenishtchev's manner toward Madame Karenina, when he was taken to call on her, was all that Vronsky could have desired. Evidently, without the slightest effort, he steered clear of all subjects that might lead to embarrassment. He had never met Anna before, and was struck by her beauty, and still more by the frankness with which she accepted her position. She blushed when Vronsky brought in Golenishtchev, and he was extremely charmed by this childish blush overspreading her candid and beautiful face. But what he liked particularly was the way in which at once, as though on purpose, so that there might be no misunderstanding with an outsider, she called Vronsky simply Alexei, and said that they were moving into a house they had just taken, what was locally called a palazzo. Golenishtchev liked this direct and simple attitude toward her own position. Looking at Anna's manner of simple-hearted, spirited gaiety, and knowing Alexei Alexandrovitch and Vronsky, Golenishtchev thought that he understood her perfectly. He thought that he understood what she was utterly unable to understand, how it was that having made her husband wretched, having abandoned him and her son, and lost her good name, she yet felt full of energy, gaiety, and happiness.
"It's in the guidebook," said Golenishtchev, referring to the palazzo Vronsky had taken. "There's a first-rate Tintoretto there, one of his last period. I tell you what, it's a lovely day. Let's go and have another look at it," said Vronsky, addressing Anna.
"I shall be very glad to. I'll go and put on my hat. You say it's hot," she said, stopping at the door and looking inquiringly at Vronsky. And again a vivid flush overspread her face.
Vronsky saw from her eyes that she didn't know on what terms he cared to be with Golenishtchev, and so was afraid of not behaving as he would wish. He looked at her with a long, tender look.
"No, not very," he said.
And it seemed to her that she understood everything, most of all that he was pleased with her, and smiling to him, she walked out with her rapid step. The friends glanced at one another, and a look of hesitation came into both faces, as though Golenishtchev, unmistakably admiring her, would have liked to say something about her, and couldn't find the right thing to say, while Vronsky desired and dreaded his doing so.
"Well, then," Vronsky began to start a conversation of some sort. "So you're settled here. You're still at the same work, then?"
he went on, recalling that he'd been told Golenishtchev was writing something.
"Yes. I'm writing the second part of The Two Principles," said Golenishtchev, colouring with pleasure at the question. "That is, to be exact, I'm not writing it yet. I'm preparing, collecting materials. It will be a far wider scope, and will touch on almost all questions. We in Russia refuse to see that we are the heirs of Byzantium." And he launched into a long and heated explanation of his views. Vronsky, at the first moment, felt embarrassed at not even knowing of the first part of The Two Principles, of which the author spoke as something well known. But as Golenishtchev began to lay down his opinions, and Vronsky was able to follow them even without knowing The Two Principles, he listened to him with some interest, for Golenishtchev spoke well. But Vronsky was startled and annoyed by the irritable excitement with which Golenishtchev talked of the subject that engrossed him. As he went on talking, his eyes glittered more and more angrily. He was more and more hurried in his replies to imaginary opponents, and his face grew more and more excited and worried. Remembering Golenishtchev, a thin, lively, good-natured and well-bred boy, always at the head of the class, Vronsky couldn't make out the reason for his irritability, and he didn't like it. What he particularly disliked was that Golenishtchev, a man belonging to good society, should put himself on a level with some scribblers with whom he was irritated and angry. Was it worth it? Vronsky disliked it, yet he felt that Golenishtchev was unhappy and was sorry for him. Unhappiness, almost insanity, was visible on his mobile, rather handsome face, while without even noticing Anna's coming in, he went on hurriedly and hotly expressing his views. When Anna came back in her hat and cape, her lovely hand rapidly swinging her parasol, and stood beside him, it was with a feeling of relief that Vronsky broke away from the plaintive eyes of Golenishtchev, which fastened persistently upon him, and with a fresh rush of love looked at his charming companion, full of life and happiness. Golenishtchev recovered himself with an effort, and at first was dejected and gloomy, but Anna, disposed to feel friendly with everyone as she was at that time, soon revived his spirits by her direct and lively manner. After trying various subjects of conversation, she got him onto painting, of which he talked very well, and she listened to him attentively. They walked to the house they had taken, and went over it. "I'm very glad of one thing," said Anna to Golenishtchev when they were on their way back. "Alexei will have a wonderful atelier. You must certainly take that room," she said to Vronsky in Russian, using the familiarity as though she saw that Golenishtchev would become intimate with them in their isolation, and that there was no need for reserve before him. "Do you paint?" said Golenishtchev, turning around quickly to Vronsky. "Yes. I used to study long ago, and now I've begun to do a little," said Vronsky, reddening.
"He has great talent," said Anna, with a delighted smile. "I'm no judge, of course, but good judges have said the same."
Chapter 8 Anna, in that first period of her emancipation and rapid return to health, felt herself unpardonably happy and full of the joy of life. The thought of her husband's unhappiness didn't poison her happiness. On one side, that memory was too awful to be thought of. On the other side, her husband's unhappiness had given her too much happiness to be regretted. The memory of all that had happened after her illness, her reconciliation with her husband, its breakdown, the news of Vronsky's wound, his visit, the preparations for divorce, the departure from her husband's house, the parting from her son, all that seemed to her like a delirious dream from which she had awakened abroad and alone with Vronsky. The thought of the harm caused to her husband aroused in her a feeling like repulsion, like what a drowning man might feel who has shaken off another man clinging to him. That man did drown. It was wrong, of course, but it was the sole means of escape, and better not to brood over such horrible details.
One consolatory reflection upon her conduct had occurred to her at the first moment of the final break, and when now she recalled all the past, she remembered that one reflection. "I have inevitably made that man wretched," she thought, "but I don't want to profit by his misery. I, too, am suffering, and shall suffer. I am losing what I prized above everything. I'm losing my good name and my son. I have done wrong, and so I don't want happiness. I don't want a divorce, and shall suffer from my shame and separation from my child." But however sincerely Anna had meant to suffer, she wasn't suffering. Shame there was not. With a tact of which both had such a large share, they had succeeded in avoiding Russian ladies abroad, and so had never placed themselves in a false position, and everywhere they had met people who pretended that they perfectly understood their position, far better indeed than they did themselves. Separation from the son she loved, even that didn't cause her anguish in these early days. The baby girl, his child, was so sweet, and had so won Anna's heart, since she was all that was left her, that Anna rarely thought of her son. The desire for life, waxing stronger with recovered health, was so intense, and the conditions of life were so new and pleasant, that Anna felt unpardonably happy. The more she got to know Vronsky, the more she loved him. She loved him for himself, and for his love for her. Her complete ownership of him was a continual joy to her. His presence was always sweet to her. All the traits of his character, which she learned to know better and better, were unutterably precious to her. His appearance, changed by his civilian dress, was as fascinating to her as though she were some young girl in love. In everything he said, thought, did, she saw something particularly noble and elevated. Her adoration of him alarmed her. She sought and couldn't find in him anything not beautiful. She dared not show him her feeling of her own inferiority beside him. It seemed to her that, knowing this, he might sooner cease to love her, and she dreaded nothing now so much as losing his love, though she had no grounds for fearing it. But she couldn't help being grateful to him for his attitude toward her, and showing that she appreciated it. He, who had in her opinion such a marked aptitude for a political career, in which he would have been certain to play a leading part, he had sacrificed his ambition for her sake, and never betrayed the slightest regret. He was more lovingly respectful to her than ever, and the constant care that she should not feel the awkwardness of her position never deserted him for a single instant. He, so manly a man, never opposed her, had indeed with her no will of his own, and was anxious, it seemed, for nothing but to anticipate her wishes. And she could not but appreciate this, even though the very intensity of his solicitude for her, the atmosphere of care with which he surrounded her, sometimes weighed upon her. Vronsky, meanwhile, in spite of the complete realization of what he had so long desired, was not perfectly happy. He soon felt that the realization of his desires gave him no more than a grain of sand of the mountain of happiness he had expected. It showed him the mistake men make in picturing to themselves happiness as the realization of their desires. For a time, after joining his life to hers and putting on civilian dress, he had felt all the delight of freedom in general, of which he had known nothing before, and of freedom in his love, and he was content, but not for long. He was soon aware that there was springing up in his heart a desire for desires, ennui. Without conscious intention, he began to clutch at every passing caprice, taking it for a desire and an object. 16 hours of the day must be occupied in some way, since they were living abroad in complete freedom, outside the conditions of social life which filled up time in Petersburg. As for the amusements of bachelor existence, which had provided Vronsky with entertainment on previous tours abroad, they couldn't be thought of, since the sole attempt of the sort had led to a sudden attack of depression in Anna, quite out of proportion with the cause, a late supper with bachelor friends. Relations with the society of the place, foreign and Russian, were equally out of the question owing to the irregularity of their position. The inspection of objects of interest, apart from the fact that everything had been seen already, had not for Vronsky, a Russian and a sensible man, the immense significance Englishmen are able to attach to that pursuit. And just as the hungry stomach eagerly accepts every object it can get, hoping to find nourishment in it, Vronsky quite unconsciously clutched first at politics, then at new books, and then at pictures. As he had from childhood a taste for painting, and as, not knowing what to spend his money on, he had begun collecting engravings, he came to a stop at painting, began to take interest in it, and concentrated upon it the unoccupied mass of desires which demanded satisfaction. He had a ready appreciation of art, and for accurately and tastefully imitating it, and he supposed himself to have the real qualities essential for an artist, and after hesitating for some time about which style of painting to select, religious, historical, realistic, or genre painting, he began painting. He appreciated all kinds, and could have felt inspired by any of them, but he had no conception of the possibility of knowing nothing at all of any school of painting, and of being inspired directly by what is within the soul, without caring whether what is painted will belong to any recognized school. Since he knew nothing of this, and drew his inspiration not directly from life, but indirectly from life embodied in art, his inspiration came very quickly and easily. And just as quickly and easily came his success in painting something very similar to the sort of painting he was trying to imitate. More than any other style, he liked the French, graceful and effective, and in that style he began to paint Anna's portrait in Italian costume, and the portrait seemed to him, and to everyone who saw it, extremely successful.